Hey, we're going to continue this morning with what, this is no exaggeration, may very well be the most important thing we do every single week when we come together as a church. No offense to the teacher, certainly no offense taken as the person who's usually leading music. The most important thing we can do as a church every single time we gather together is to proclaim out loud with boldness and confidence these sacred texts. And so this is not a throwaway part of our service. This is not just an introduction to the sermon. We feel like this is a massive part of the church's role is to proclaim these sacred words. And so when we come to this spot each week, whoever is up here helping us to continue to worship by reading these things out loud, this is a key moment in our worshiping life for us to turn our ears and our hearts to listen to these words be spoken in a public place. That's pretty remarkable that in a public place, these words get to be spoken out loud. And so I thought it might be helpful to remind us of why we come to this moment each time. So lifelong friend and part of our community, Beth Van Dyke, is going to help us continue the worship this morning by reading these words. So let's attune our hearts and our ears to listen.
A reading from Matthew 16, 13 through 19. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked the disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of death will not overcome it. I will give you the keys to the kingdom, the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." The word of the Lord.
So good to see you all today. If you don't have a Bible, you will need one. You can get one on the Bible cart in the back if that's helpful. And let me start. This page is, let me make sure we're all on the same page. We're on page 905 in the Shed Bible. And if you're on a screen, well, then you're on your own. This passage is so loaded, and we read it so casually. I want to attempt to sort of unpack some stuff in this that you're going to say, "Oh, okay, that's different than I thought." Now, when Jesus came to the district of Caesarea Philippi, let me stop there for a second. Has anyone been to this place? Show of hands high if you've been to this place, just so I can see. Because if you've been to this place, then you know you've been to this place. It's not a place you go to and you're like, "Oh yeah, I was in some part of Ohio," right? Like Caesarea Philippi is a rememberable place, right? It's not like East Lansing. So that's it. I'm done. I said it. I'm moving on. So that wasn't in the notes. There was no premeditated violence there. Okay. Troy, you got this? I'm done. Okay, so let me begin with a question that is the most important question that applies very little to everyday life. If you could choose any superpower, which would it be? Telepathy? Time travel, maybe? Flying? Superhuman strength? Marie Kondo folding skills? Troy, what would you choose?
Invisibility.
Really?
Don't judge.
Invisibility? It's a total 4 or 5 on the Enneagram right there. Christine, are you in here? What would you choose?
Healing sick people?
So biblical. Take that, Troy. This is Tim Nelson. I think I was Tim. Tim, are you here?
Teleporting?
It's interesting that you said that because teleportation would be what I would want to do. I would want to teleport all of you right now to Caesarea Philippi. Not then, but now, because then you'll see why not then in a second. But to this day, so when you're walking up to Caesarea Philippi, you can feel like residue from the past. Have you ever been to one of those places before? I felt it in certain cities where you walk in and you can feel the past. It's like it kind of hangs right there in the humidity of the atmosphere. And Caesarea Philippi is one of those places for me. It's kind of eerie. It's kind of thick. It's like a pagan hangover that's happening in that area. And it's located, here's a map for you. It's 26 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. Now remember, the Sea of Galilee is where Jesus spends at least 75% of his ministry in that region, particularly within like a triangle, even a smaller triangle in that region. The Sea of Galilee there, you can see that it's on the sort of north part of even that slide. And as you go north 26 miles, you can see what's in the square right there of Caesarea Philippi. And so it's about a day and a half day's walk at this time, right? And this is a fascinating text because it's beyond the region where Jesus does most, if not all, of his ministry. And then Jesus would go south and in different places, but not here. And for the disciples, for most, if I would probably say all of them, none of them have been here at this point. This is the first time in their lives. Can you imagine living a kind of life where you had not been 26 miles north of where you now live? This wasn't the kind of place you would go to, particularly if you were Jewish. This was a Roman settlement. This place had been settled by Alexander the Great centuries before, and he created it as a tribute to what god? Does anyone know? Anyone remember the god? Zeus was a part of it, but there was another prominent god here. It was the god Pan. Pan was this half man, half goat god of fertility. I wouldn't recommend Googling him. About half of you probably just pull out your phone. Stop. Don't do it. Just trust me. When you first arrive at Caesarea Philippi, you're confronted with this rock, right? So you come up on the stone there and you look up and there's this just gigantic face of a rock. And then you look to the left of that rock on the floor, you can see the remnants of what was a platform to the god Pan. To the right on the screen, there was a house for Zeus, and this platform of Pan that I labeled there on the ground, right below that rock, it was a place where the disciples would have come. I mean, imagine them. Here they are. They're stumbling into this new place, and you can hear the sounds. What does it sound like? It sounds like erotica. The sights are of naked female dancers, ready to perform sexual sacrifice with any man who wanted the blessing of Pan. Husbands, what was your role here? To worship. Women, what was your role? To be faithful to your husbands. That's Roman culture, right? Not a healthy culture for a happy marriage. These were the days before John and Julie Gottman. A very different reality here of what's happening at Caesarea Philippi. Next to the platform, there's this structure you can see here to the left on this where they housed goats for mating purposes that went in front of, now go to this next slide, it went in front of what's now this cave. So that little house is gone now, but if you rock up today, this is what you see. You see this empty cave and this platform right next to it. Now, what was going on in this cave? There's this abundant supply of this water that seems to go down into the depths of the earth. And it was so abundant, which is why Alexander the Great wanted to establish a settlement there. And it would flow out from this place. And the belief at the time went something like this, that Pan would slip down into that place to go to sleep, what they called the underworld. And every day, Pan would come back up. And that you would put him, you can see those little circles that I have in there, that you had these gods that would then be represented in that place, and Pan was one of them. That the idea was that the god would go down into the earth and come back and give presence to this place. Okay, we're in this series right now, this three-part conversation before Lent, about our vision, about who we are after 20 years. How do we reclaim the things we've always been and also move into a place of clarity toward our future? And we talked about what it means to be a Jesus people for the sake of the world. That our mission statement remains the same. Our direction and our narrative theology, all of those things remain the same. They're on the website. You can find them in the Welcome Center. All those things to help you understand, well, who is Marcel? But we said we want a vision statement that in 5 seconds we can put in our pocket and pull out to say, who is Marcel? We are a Jesus people for the sake of the world. So what does this text have to do with that statement? What's the connection there, AJ? I'm not seeing that. Are you trying to force something here? I want you to put yourself in the shoes of these disciples. My take, the disciples are teenagers. I think John's around 9. I think Peter might be 20. The rest of them are somewhere in between. High school sophomores, right? And you have to be thinking that in this little journey that Jesus has got them on, you got to be thinking, they're like, hey, listen, our parents never brought us here. What are we doing here? This is NC-17 stuff. And we've heard of this place, but we've never been here before. Jesus, why are we here? Like our vision statement, what does this have to do with us? There's this moment in The Lord of the Rings, if you've seen the films, where it's like the sentimental music comes up and it's this tickly moment in the bush where they've just left the Shire for the first time and Frodo and Sam are in this dialogue and Sam goes, oh, this is it. Do you remember this part? And Frodo turns around and he's like, this is what? And he's like, this is, if I take one more step, this is the furthest away from home that I've ever been. And you know, the crescendo happens and he takes the step, right? I think it's that kind of a moment for the disciples. Only it's probably not quite as exciting. They're probably scared out of their minds, thinking we've never stepped this far into uncharted territory. I think this is their Mordor. This is the Mordor of the Middle East in the first century for a Jewish, Torah-loving kid. And when we read the text, we can't miss that. It's so easy to open this text up and just to go, well, when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, you know, as if like he's just going to the kitchen. No. This is something very different. And it's loaded. And to begin to understand what they were stepping into, this is where Jesus brought his teenage disciples. This isn't Young Life, right? This isn't what Kyle's doing at Anthem. This is super dark. This is Stranger Things. What is Jesus doing? Verse 13 here. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? I mean, you got to be thinking like, well, we could have answered that question back home in the Shire. Why are we here? And Jesus has a pop quiz for them. And so they sort of dialogue through this. Skip down to verse 16. Simon Peter says, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Now, I think he probably said it like this. You're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Why? Shh. Don't awaken the gods. The people will go crazy. A Jesus people. This is what we're settling into today, this idea of people. We talked about Jesus last week as the centrality of our existence. Not my name, not some brand, not someone else's name, not some author, not some pastor. The name of Jesus is to define the community of Mars Hill. And I want to suggest that as Peter announces the identity of Jesus, whether it was a whisper or a shout or somewhere in between, what I want to suggest and why this verse matters to me when it comes to this part of our vision statement is that as he utters that proclamation, I want to suggest he becomes the first member of the church. That he becomes the first of the Jesus people in human history. That naming the identity of the Son of God creates something new in the world for the first time. And I want to imagine saying in this place, I think the other disciples are like, shh, keep it down. We're in pan country. Verse 17, Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. For this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father who is in heaven. I know that West Michigan is culturally loaded with the duty of religion. But the true church, the people who say we rally around Jesus, are those who have been drawn to it by the Holy Spirit. Some of you are here maybe for the first time, or you just do this. Maybe your car isn't the main reason you're here. Like maybe there's something deep in the mystery of the universe that has been wooing you into a communion that has a greater proclamation than ourselves, than our 80-some years if we're lucky, than our accolades and our education status or our income levels or our job. Maybe there's something bigger that's wooing you to a larger proclamation in life. And look at this proclamation. Look at the exclamation point of Jesus. I don't think he says, "Bless you, Simon, son of Jonah. This was revealed to you by flesh and blood, not but by my Father in heaven." I think they're looking over the rocks and they're seeing an orgy happening. And the disciples are like, "Just don't let them know we're here." And I think Jesus, in response to the proclamation, is probably turning his voice toward that pan sort of stage that was going on, saying, "Blessed are you, Simon. Blessed are you, because this was not revealed by flesh and blood and what these people are doing here. That's not a revelation. It was revealed by the deep cosmic mystery that God is, and that is going to die, but I'm going to live forever and with you." I think there's something happening here that we can miss when we read too quickly in verse 17, that the Jesus people are not like any other organized society. We're not better or worse, but we're summoned together by a mysterious power greater than ourselves. And what we share in common, we share a lot, some things in common. We differ in some things as well, which I really like. I really like how we're different in many ways. But the thing we share in common is this proclamation that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. I don't care how you vote. Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Maybe that's what's drawn you to this place. I pray that in our years ahead, that's what would draw people to this place, is that our proclamation is about something greater than our own names and our own branding. In verse 18, here's what he says, "And I tell you that you are Peter." So he gets a name change here, right? So something's new's happened in history. Simon utters a confession. So Jesus changes his name. And you've heard this passage before, if not once, then 1,000 times. "On this rock I will build my church. And the gates of death," or the gates of Hades, the gates of hell is another way to say that, "it will not overcome it." I don't like the gates of death interpretation there. I think it loses the pungency of the text and what it's meant to do. He's saying, "You're Peter. I want you to remember who you are. Remember where they are." What do you do when you come into Caesarea Philippi? You see a rock, and you're enveloped in this environment where you're intimidated, and you think, "This is a powerful place, and I don't know, I'm shaking in my boots here, I'm shaking in my sandals, I don't know what my proclamation is. Maybe this is the right God. It seems like there's a lot of energy moving in this direction." I think Jesus is doing a wordplay here with the first member of the church. I love the Roman Catholic Church. I don't think they get this text right. I love the Roman Catholic Church. Let me just say that. They're our brothers and sisters. I don't think he's saying you are the unique rock that all of history will now look to Rome. I think he's saying, no, when you make that proclamation, you see that rock right there, that big thing, and that pan thing happening right underneath it? When anyone makes the proclamation that I'm the Son of God, they become a rock. And by the way, that rock is no longer about temples and stones and bricks. It's about people. I am putting something powerful into my people. And you see that rock right there? It's coming down. And my power is going to move through people being awakened to love and compassion and loving the marginalized and not utilizing our power to manipulate and get more, but utilizing our power for those who are suffering, for the poor and the weak. The church is designed to use our power differently. And Jesus showed us how to do that. And so you see that rock there, Simon? You're the rock now. And I'm going to build my church on confessions like you, because that's where I can live. And it's not going to have any power, that rock up there, compared to what I'll do in you. And so how do they get there? Well, they proclaim the name. Peter doesn't proclaim his own name. He proclaims the mystery of the universe, that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Verse 18, B, the gates of death will not overcome it, or the gates of Hades. What are the gates of Hades? You remember that grotto, that cave? You know what they called that? Gates of Hades. Go back to that cave. You'd stumble up and you'd see that cave. Yeah, that's where Pan descends into hell. That's the gate where the power comes from. Oh, it was powerful, don't get me wrong. There's a spiritual thing happening all over the universe. And he said, you see that gate there, that entrance to that thing? Yeah, that is going down. That will not prevail. My power, my people will prevail over the gates of Hades. And I know it looks frightening, and I know it's scary, and I know it seems like, do I have the right story in the living God? Yes, that will go away. And you go today to Caesarea Philippi, and it's a monument. It's nothing. There's no power there anymore. It's gone. Peter becomes the first member of the church here. You know, we can read this text casually from the comfort of suburbia, but these guys have been probably shaking in their sandals, and I think Jesus is saying, don't be afraid, my friends. I know looking at this, I know it feels frightening in this cultural moment, and I'm calling a people to proclaim my name and who will announce reality to the world. There's a reason there's an exclamation point in this text when Jesus is talking, because he's not afraid to announce it. He's not afraid to proclaim it. He doesn't want to minimize reality. And they will then do deeds of doing justly, loving mercy, and walking humbly. Those are my people, people that proclaim my name and walk in my way. Verse 19, where we end this text. Then I'll try to make some sense of this before we go. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. There's a lot we could say about this text, but we'll just leave it at this. He gives us the keys that unlock powers that the gates of Hades know nothing of. So let me try to pull this together. Vladimir Lasky was a Russian theologian. And profoundly so. He had one of his students that asked him this age-old question you've heard before. Can God make a rock too heavy for God to move? You heard this one? Right? It's a great philosophical question. And Lasky, in the conversation, immediately replied this. He already has. The human heart. Just the freedom that God gives us to opt in to the proclamation or to minimize it and say, you know what, I think I'll pass and do my thing over here or do this thing over here. I'm going to tell you, when God gets a hold of this rock and transforms it from stone to flesh, it catches fire. And you cannot help but proclaim the mystery from the rooftops. Many of you have been there, you know what I'm talking about. Some of us are longing to be back in that spot where, yes, God set my heart on fire. I feel like my proclamation has been so minimized recently, so subdued. God, reawaken me. Reawaken me that with Peter, I might say, Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Because that's the stuff that the kingdom's made of. Now, here's what I want to say about a Jesus people. We've heard a lot of great teachings over the years about community And I love how even our staff have worked so hard for short circles and house churches and formation school, all these amazing things. We've heard that before, that being a church is about not just loving a Sunday event, but about being a people, relating, getting to know people, and actually using gifts and inserting voice and even giving some money here and there. Like this idea that we are a people together in this greater thing with other churches doing a greater thing in the world because we believe Jesus is renewing all things. And so we've heard a lot of great teachings on that. We've heard a lot of great teachings on belonging, on what it means that our first step toward every person everywhere would be one of love and grace. That our first step toward people is not judgment and condemnation. No matter who it is, our first step is curiosity and intrigue. That I want to know you, that you matter to the world, that you matter to God, that you're made in God's image. That everyone deserves dignity no matter what. But I want to say something else today about being a people. We've heard a lot of those talks, and they're really good. I want to say something else based on this text. I'm asking questions like, okay, what actually makes a Jesus people? What actually makes us a church? And I think the answer to that question lies at Caesarea Philippi. We are not a Jesus people because we say so. Notice Peter doesn't proclaim himself here. He proclaims another name. We are not the church because we tacked on the word church to the end of our branding, Mars Hill Bible. When God thinks about the church, it's not in name that we have named things. The church doesn't exist because a group of elders decide to apply for a 501c3. Right? I've church planted before in Los Angeles years ago, and I remember thinking, well, what legitimizes us as a church? Like, that's pretty lofty language. Like, when did we become a church? When do we become a church? When does that happen? When does that take place? We are not the church because we say so. We become a church to the extent that we, like Peter, proclaim his name and live out his way. And that happens both personally and communally. Let me say this again. We only become the church when we proclaim the name and live the way. When we don't do that, we cease to be a church. The church are those whose center is Jesus and whose way is the kingdom. And where that isn't happening, no matter what you call yourself, you're not the church. Why? Because the church is something that together we become along the way. The church is not a static entity that we attend once a week. It's a way of being that, according to this text, Jesus says, it's not inspired by you and your organizational skills. Those are all fine and good. It's inspired by my presence among you, that you've been called by the Father and that you've been animated by the Spirit and you proclaim my kingdom and not your own. I love this sentence. I really do. I mean it. I love church shopping, or I'm church shopping, right? I love that sentence. I get it. I've been there. Maybe that's why you're here. And so I'll often respond when I hear that sentence. Okay, great. So like, you know, what are you shopping for? What are you hoping for? What's on your list? Well, you see, we want a church that has good kids ministry and preferably with a quick check-in so we don't have to stand in line. And hey, the worship should be energetic, but you know, throw in some hymns there because, you know, occasionally we had that growing up and it reminds us of Aunt Sally's country church, and that's a good thing. You know, and community, it should be lively, but not too energetic because that's weird. And preaching, it needs to be relevant, but biblical, right? And stay preferably under 25 minutes because, you know, Anna's house gets crowded quickly, right? And we like some racial diversity, you know, when we arrive. I mean, we ourselves don't have any friends that aren't white, but we like to be a part of a community where we can feel that we aren't as white on Sundays as we are the rest of the week, right? And we like communion, but maybe not every week, quarterly maybe, perhaps. Every week is too much, but we do like it a little bit, so once a year is not enough. I mean, we're actually not that picky about church. We're up for anything, right? So, great, thanks for sharing. I prefer some of those things, I get it. But I think historically the answer is we're searching for a place. where Jesus is the cry of the heart of the people, and where the people long to see the kingdom of God made manifest in the world. Historically, the church flourishes where you have a Jesus people for the sake of the world. I had an image earlier, I threw it out in the slides, but it's that, you know, that Nile Delta image from space, where you can see the water coming down the Nile into the desert, and it's brown everywhere except where that water is, and it's green all by the water. Yeah, that's what happens when Jesus becomes the center of the community. You might sort of spike and be animated for a while when you're centered in your own sort of longings and your own sort of willfulness, but you won't go long. You won't last long. It's when you're rooted in Christ, and that when you have a kind of power, John 15 is a great place for this, where you abide in such a way that you flow into the world and all people begin to matter to you because they matter to God. Every year, Christian publications, they put out the 40 fastest growing churches. I think we were on it at one point. And, churches that make that list every year, they're like promoted on social media. And I read it, I think, there's no judgment here. It's just this, that the point of the church is not the church. The point of the church is not our brand. It's not our ideas or programs. It's not our uniqueness. The point of the church is to point to the point. And that point is Jesus of Nazareth. And then to live it out. The church is not a place that says, look what we've done, look how fast we can grow. The church are people who point beyond themselves and say, look who he is, and may we grow as we grow in him, and he sets our heart on fire. Karl Barth says that the community of Jesus Christ is not a reality which exists for its own sake. It exists because it has a commission and what it knows it has to tell the world. Marcel, we're a Jesus people for the sake of the world. And I close with this. Let me give you an application here. I think it's helpful. When was the last time you were obsessed with the Gospels? What I'm finding in my life right now is a need to get back being rooted into the life and ministry of Jesus every day. I've been listening to them instead of podcasts or music in the car recently. I'm reading the Gospels in the morning before I launch into my day. And I think my application to this message and to this vision statement is never leave the Gospel. Like the Jewish people, bind them somehow metaphorically on your foreheads. The church is designed to bind the gospel into our hearts so that we can live them out. You can't live what you don't know. And what you don't know will never drive you to be a different kind of human in the world. I remember Ray Vanderland said years ago, this must have been 15 years, he was talking to a rabbi in Israel. And he told the rabbi that Jesus was his rabbi, and the rabbi said, unless you're reading the Gospels every week, you cannot be a disciple of Jesus. If he's your rabbi, you'll be obsessed with him. You'll think about him everywhere you go. What would it be like to walk in his shoes here? What does it mean for my work and my home and my play? What does it mean for my finances? What does it mean for the way in which I give my life and how I raise my kids? What is Jesus? How does he inform and inspire me to live this thing out? In the words of Ben Myers, the Australian theologian, Jesus wrote no books. He established no institutions, and he didn't seem particularly interested in founding a new religion. He was the author not of ideas, but of a way of life. Everything Jesus believed to be important was entrusted to his small circle of followers. He showed them his own unique way of being alive, his way of living and loving and feasting and forgiving and teaching and dying. And he invited them to live in the same way. Four of Jesus' followers left records of what he said and what he was like, and I get to spend my life continually pondering those four accounts. I read them not because I'm studying ideas about Jesus, but because I'm studying him. I want everything in my life, right down to the smallest, most disappointing details, to enter somehow into communion with the life of Jesus. I want my whole life to be hidden with Christ in God. I want my small story to be tucked into the folds of Jesus' story. We devote our lives to the Gospels not because we want to know them, but because we want to know him. Not because we want to know about them, but because we want to be like him. So may it be so with us. Friends, if you're willing and able, would you stand with me?